Welcome to Winning STL, where we have conversations about how St. Louis can best compete and win in the battle for talent, jobs, growth, and equity. Winning STL is presented by Purina, who creates richer lives for pets and the people who love them, and is proudly called St. Louis home since 1894. Today, we are downtown at the Post Building, a dynamic workspace for geospatial and fintech in St. Louis. Joining me today is Dr. Alexander Garza, former Assistant Secretary for Health Affairs and Chief Medical Officer of the Department of Homeland Security. Today, he serves as Chief Community Health Officer at SSM Health. Dr. Garza, thanks so much for joining us today.
Pleasure to be here.
In addition to your long and prestigious background in medicine, you've got a military background.
Colonel,
I believe, is it in the reserves?
Right.
And you served in Iraq. You've been decorated the Bronze Star. Tell us about the service and what are the applications from that in your life today?
Yeah, a lot of things you take away from the military that are applicable, you know, to your civilian job or your civilian life. A couple of those, so my career in the military has been very sort of unconventional. So typically physicians go, they join like a Army Combat Hospital or Field Hospital, something along those lines. I joined a unit called Civil Affairs, which is sort of the hearts and minds strategy for the U.S. Army. So I led a small team, a public health team, for 15 years of my career in the military. And so when I deployed to Iraq, it wasn't necessarily as a combat physician. It was more of a, how do we go in and rebuild the nation so that it can get back up on its feet? And so it fits really well with some of the work that I do now in community health and with public health and all these other things. So my role in when I was deployed is to work with the host nation government to try and understand the environment, understand what are the problems, what are the issues, how can we help get you back up on your feet so that we can stabilize the community, so therefore people aren't wanting to join an insurgency and shoot at us. But also, I mean, if my ultimate end state is I want to leave your country someday, but I want to leave it stable. That's how you do it. You have to make sure the infrastructure is in place that's going to be able to serve the people, that is stable, that is not going to fall victim to an insurgency or another group that wants to seize power. And part of the reason is to make sure that you can protect the combatant commander from, you know, populations that want to turn against us. So it's a very different role than you would find a lot of physicians doing.
You seem to gravitate to the most difficult, near impossible assignments. I believe, and something I'd read that people might remember the name of the town, Tikrit, where Saddam Hussein was from.
Yeah.
Were you not at one point stationed in one of his homes or palaces?
I was.
Is that true?
Yeah. So I lived on the palace ground. So he's from Tikrit. Saddam Hussein's family's from Tikrit.
Right.
Actually from a town south of Tikrit called Hoxha. But the palace it's this 8-square-mile compound. My battalion, the 418th Civil Affairs Battalion, occupied, of all things, the hospital building in the palace grounds.
Seems fitting.
So it was Suleiman province. So that's where we operated out of. We had an office down in downtown Tikrit, which we called the Civil Military Information Center, or the CIMIC, that we would go to every day to run our missions out of. But every day, myself and my team were out, you know, visiting hospitals, medical schools, nursing schools, rehabilitation hospitals, the pharmaceutical buildings, all of these different medical schools, all of these different organizations to see how could we, the U.S. government, U.S. Army, help them to get back to where they needed to be a fully functioning government. And I make it sound a little bit easy. It was extremely difficult.
I can't imagine anyone thinks that was easy.
Yeah. So just understanding the political environment that is involved in Saddam Hussein, the post-fall of Saddam Hussein's world, was fascinating. Even just the different political parties, so you learned a lot about Islam, so the different sects of Islam, the Shia, the Sunni, the Kurds up in the north are not Arabs, so they don't necessarily like the Arabs. So you had to understand, like, okay, this person isn't going to like this person, and these two people aren't going to get along. So in many ways, it was great training for the pandemic. So you had to understand, like, who is thinking this different way? What way are they going to approach this problem? But I'll share this really brief story. So we were getting ready to replace the director of health for Sula Den. So if you remember back, CPA Paul Bremer said, hey, everybody that was in the bath party has to go, right? So that meant...
In retrospect, that might have been problematic.
Yes, it
all
was.
All these military-aged and military figures all of a sudden don't have a job.
And they have guns and they're trained.
And they're not a minority in their own...
Exactly.
Country, so.
so not a good move. So the health director, though, was bath party, so was removed. It was probably a good move. He wasn't a very good guy. So, but then there was a vacuum, like who's going to lead health for Sula Den? So I devised this method. So I'm learning on this on the fly. So I said, well, we should probably ask the people, like, who do you want to be your health director? So we had them send in resumes and make sure that we vetted everybody to understand, like, who they were. And then all the health directors for the different hospitals and clinics were going to come together, and we were going to vote on who's going to be the health director. So very democratic process. The day of, all of the candidates, and there's probably about 10 candidates, dropped out except for two people. There's a ton of people there. I go up to the health director's office, who I had installed as the interim until we had come up with a permanent. And I said, what happened? And he said, last night, everybody that filled out an application got a note, an anonymous note, that was wrapped up in an AK-47 bullet with a DNR, and said a bullet costs less than a DNR. So only two people remained. One was this gentleman from Osia City. So remember I told you Saddam's from Osia.
Okay.
So we kind of knew him. This other guy I had never met. His name was Dr. Hassan. And so the reason why he didn't get a threat is he was a Turk. And so the Arabs were afraid to go into the Turk part of the country to go threaten this guy. So they both showed up. But then you're presented with this dilemma. Do I allow this election to go on, because I don't know how it's going to turn out. So we decided we're going to let it run its course. But it turned out the Turkmen won the election. The other person was his brother was one of Saddam Hussein's top lieutenants. We didn't learn this until later. All the people that were in the hallway were people that he had brought in that he was going to replace the whole regime with his handpicked people. Dr. Hassan was the Turkman. He won the election. I was extremely proud of the Iraqi people for not bowing to the pressure. Dr. Hassan just became this wonderful, wonderful partner and was just completely unafraid. Like, he would get assassination attempts on his life and would still just be like, yep, we're just going to go.
So you really, got the right man.
We got the right man.
Even if by a little bit of fortune,
yes,
to get there.
Yeah. But just that whole experience was just like, wow, this is crazy. Like, who does this?
I wonder if that, you seem to have a kind of a natural optimism when confronting some of the things that we had in St. Louis. Maybe there's a compare and contrast that you say, look, if we can successfully operate there, we got it, no problem.
Well, but that translates into a couple of things. And so one of the things I think we don't learn as much from the military is that the military spends a lot of time trying to understand the political, the social, the economic, the religious environment that they operate in. Because after all, they don't want people to turn against them. They don't want to foment an insurgency. They don't want people to be distracting them from what their mission is. And so part of the mission, when we're in combat, is also how can I stabilize the community so that I don't have to fight everybody? Like, we don't mind fighting
the
enemy.
Just the bad guys,
right, but we don't want to invite more bad guys in. And the way that you do that is through economic development, through opening the schools, through, keeping people occupied. And like, we create jobs and we paid people to do things at our base just to pay them so that they wouldn't be out throwing rocks at us. But that creates stability in the community, that builds trust, that does all of those other things that I think we don't learn as much from the military as we do all of the other tactical things, like You know a soldier when they're in their battle rattle, but what you don't see is when we're sitting around drinking tea and trying to discuss, hey, what are the big social issues that we really need to solve for so that we can leave this country one day and leave it stable? That's a big lesson that we don't understand.
Just curious, if I don't know the last time you were there, but you probably have a pretty good handle on what's going on. Do you feel like, considering the immense limitations and challenges, do you feel like it was left in a better place than in the moment when you got there?
I think that probably...
Is that too tough of a question?
I do think it's better than when we got there, but without a doubt. Some things are still a work in progress. So, and the Middle East is a very different environment than North America or Western Europe. There's a lot of tribalism. There's a lot of other issues that have been around for generations that we're not going to solve in 10 years. So is it better now? Yes. Is it still a work in progress? Absolutely. Are there some cultural differences or other things that it's going to be close to impossible to overcome? We saw that in Afghanistan. Absolutely. So part of, I think, what we need to do as well is sort of set our expectations. So I distinctly remember having this argument with a major who was actually one of my superiors, but it was like, don't you think we're here to establish democracy? And I said, no, I think we're here to let the people sort of develop the way that they want to be governed. Sure. We're not here to foist it upon them. You're not going to create a governor or a mayor that has all power. The power is different here. So we have to respect that, and we can't expect people to bend to our will. We have to be able to work with theirs.